Good morning, Your Honor. As you know, often with an appeal, the devil's in the details, and I'll get to those details in a moment, but what I'd first like to do is kind of talk about the big picture here of what this case is about. This case is about 28 current and former ComEd employees to whom a promise was made by their employer, and that was a very important promise to them. It had to do with their pension benefits. They trusted their employer with regard to this promise, and they made decisions based upon that promise. When they discovered that it was an empty promise, they had no choice but to seek redress with this court in order to protect both themselves and their families. Unfortunately, as we stand here today, ComEd has still not had to answer for its conduct. And obviously, ultimate victory for the plaintiffs is not in the hands of this court today, but their claim does have merit. And they ask that you give them the opportunity to get that answer from ComEd. Now for the details. As you're aware, there originally were about seven plaintiffs that filed a pro se complaint. It was dismissed. They then retained an attorney, filed an amended complaint, alleging some age discrimination counts and a couple ERISA counts. That complaint was dismissed in September of 2002, and the language of that order is obviously very important here. And what the district court intended by that order is also very important. The dismissal of the ERISA counts was without prejudice. And the district court, in its ruling several months later, in which it was analyzing that earlier opinion and order, stated, and this is on page 31 of the original appendix, in this case, we dismissed the claims at issue without prejudice and fully intended that the plaintiffs be given an opportunity to amend their complaint. The deficiencies noted in our prior opinion can potentially be rectified by amendments to the complaint, and thus the dismissals without prejudice did not constitute final and appealable judgments. So then the question arises, why are we here today? And the answer is because when 7.5 months later, faced with a motion for leave to file a second amended complaint, the district court made two decisions that we believe were in error. The first one was that it had the discretion to decide whether or not leave to file that second amended complaint should be granted. And the second decision was, once the district court decided that it had such discretion, that the plaintiffs did not have the right to file a second amended complaint.
What would have happened if you just filed a new lawsuit?
I think that the plaintiffs, under the current state of the law, had their choice about which to do. And we've cited cases, Your Honor, that stand for the proposition that it's better use of judicial resources to file an amended complaint in the pending case.
Could have filed a second original complaint.
I would argue that yes, they certainly could have done that, Your Honor.
That was still within the statute of limitations.
Yes, I think by the earliest, the calculation of the earliest end of the statute of limitations, they had 7 or 8 months to do that.
Well, 7 or 8, and had the statute of limitations expired when they moved for the amended complaint?
No, I'm sorry, 7 or 8 months from the time that they moved for the second amended complaint, they still had 7 or 8 months. The case that we cite for the proposition that they had until that point in time is the U.S. Supreme Court case of Semtec. And the language in that case, I think, is very important to the decision here today. Essentially, what the court did was analyze the meaning of the phrase dismissal without prejudice. And the court said that the primary meaning of dismissal without prejudice, we think, is dismissal without barring the plaintiff from returning later to the same court with the same underlying claim. They go on to say a little bit more and conclude with, dismiss without prejudice means as removed from the court's docket in such a way that the plaintiff may refile the same suit on the same claim, and defines dismissal without prejudice again as a dismissal that does not bar the plaintiff from refiling the lawsuit within the applicable limitations period.
So amendment was really more unusual, amending it when it's without prejudice, unless the court says so in the order. You could amend it within a certain period of time.
Well, obviously, I think that would have short-circuited everything that happened here, Your Honors. there was no time period set in the September 25th order. I think this court has on numerous occasions urged the district courts to do so, to be as specific as they can be when making a decision about dismissing a complaint. That wasn't done here, and we've also cited a case for the proposition, I believe it's the Adams versus Lever case, that there shouldn't be hidden conditions in an order. If the court meant that the plaintiffs here had to file an amended complaint within a certain period of time, it should have been included in that order. This kind of leads us into the argument that's made and iterated and reiterated by ComEd in its brief, which is that this was a final judgment, the September 25th, 2002 order, and that plaintiffs were bound to file a motion pursuant to Rule 59E to open up the judgment before it could seek leave to file an amended complaint. I could go through case by case, everyone cited by ComEd here. None of them are like the case here. They're all distinguishable. In every case, the dismissal was either with prejudice. In some cases, the dismissal of the federal claims was with prejudice, but the pending state claims was without prejudice. But in that circumstance, the district court doesn't have any jurisdiction once it's dismissed the federal claims with prejudice. And there are a few cases where the dismissal was without prejudice, or it was silent as to the issue, but it was clear from the record that, in fact, the plaintiff could do nothing to amend its complaint. That whether it was because of a bar due to the statute of limitations or because of a bar due to the time it took them to serve the defendants in the case, there was something that made it clear that the decision that had been made was one on the merits. This one, the decision in this case clearly was not only by the terms of the order itself, but also by the district court's explanation in the July 3rd, 2003 order about what it intended by the September 25th order.
Well, those cases, I presume, where they're dismissed without prejudice, they could not have refiled.
Those cases are clear that in the situation
where statute of limitations, or for some reason, or they couldn't get service or something, they could not have refiled.
Absolutely. They're either
as opposed to amend.
Yes, they either stated explicitly or through a reading of the case, it's clear to the reader that that's the reason that it could not be refiled. So, in our view, this was not a final judgment, and therefore the plaintiffs did have a right to file an amended complaint. We then get to the issue of whether or not it was, again, as of right. We believe the Semtec case stands for the proposition that it was as of right.
Now, you would also argue, I presume, that dismissal without prejudice also means it's not appealable.
Exactly, Your Honor, and that's what some of these cases, a few of these cases deal with that exact proposition. They
because
deal with
it's not final.
Right. if in fact, the court found that, this court found that the district court did have discretion whether or not to grant leave to file an amended complaint, the district court here did abuse that discretion. The Foman case sets forth the situations in which plaintiffs should not be granted leave to file an amended complaint. And those circumstances include bad faith, futility, and that's where there's a little bit of an overlap between whether it's a final judgment and whether you have leave to refile.
Well, the Ordower case, I think, didn't you cite that?
Which one?
Ordower, I believe it was, which was exactly that.
I think that case is actually cited by the defendant, I believe.
That was because it was without prejudice, but they couldn't refile because
exactly.
of the statute of limitations.
Which kind of creates an interesting situation where if you have the original order that was a dismissal without prejudice, but it's clear from the record it was futile, then really 8 months later when you're analyzing whether or not you should have leave to file an amended complaint, really maybe the court should say, would have to take a look and say, well, wait a second, it was clear from the record however many months ago that it was futile for them to refile, so really the time for them to appeal was long ago and has passed. But that's not an issue in this case, but that's where there's a little crossover between those two points. The other two situations that Foman indicates are allow the district court to deny leave to file an amended complaint include situations in which there's undue delay and undue prejudice. There's no argument here about bad faith. The futility argument defendant makes in their briefs, I think that the district court made it clear that there was futility is not the issue here, that the plaintiffs could have clearly filed an amended complaint setting forth a meritorious cause of action. So the two bases on which the district court ruled against the plaintiffs was undue delay and undue prejudice. The undue delay decision of the district court stemmed from trial counsel's purported or alleged failure to file his motion for leave to file a second amended complaint for 7.5 months. And when I say that, what I mean is that the district court was pointing at that failure as being a result of some conduct that didn't occur and isn't in the record. You know, the district court made an assumption and very unflatteringly said about trial counsel that he was hunting up new clients. There's nothing in the record to support that allegation. The only thing that is in the record is that the number of plaintiffs here has fluctuated tremendously. At the point in time where he took over this case, which was after the basically after the dismissal of the First Amendment complaint, he was getting notification from a number of people who wanted to be plaintiffs. In an effort to be perhaps even extra ethical, he was requiring that each of these people sign letters indicating that he was representing them. He wanted to ensure that before he filed a complaint in their names, that they had in fact agreed that he would represent them. So for the district court to look at that and indicate that that was a basis for finding of undue delay, I think it's unfounded in the record. And that was essentially the only basis for finding undue delay. As far as prejudice, we cited cases that stand for the proposition that there really is, you have to do more than just to serve prejudice. And while in general it's true that the burden is on the moving party to show that there is no prejudice to the opposing party, some of the facts, some of the issues that have to be decided on that aren't really in the hands of the plaintiff.
Were there any status calls during that 7.5 month period, Ms. White?
Was there any
status calls?
I mean, no, nothing happened.
No court appearances from September till July?
That's correct, Your Honor. And frankly, in that time...
No discovery action either going on?
Nothing going on. Other than the trial counsel trying to ensure he knew who he was representing and revising the complaint and making it ready for filing at a point in time where the people who were calling him were a static number.
The original complaint was found wanting what?
The original complaint, it was a pro se complaint based on, and it was a discrimination complaint. Mm-hmm. And it was found wanting because it was...
And other than the adding of more parties, clearly, what was in the second amended complaint that gave it the heft that... It made it an acceptable complaint.
It is a breach of fiduciary duty claim under ERISA. The First Amendment complaint in our briefs addressed this heft did make a claim for violation of ERISA. I think perhaps it's better stated in the Second Amendment complaint as a breach of fiduciary duty under ERISA. So there was a change,
so
but the underlying
would you
fact...
would say in the 7.5 months what happened is a more professionally drafted complaint was now made?
Obviously, I don't want to cast aspersions on the person who got created the
I
agree with you.
Understand the discretion exercised, you think, inappropriately by a district judge, but he has a pro se complaint. He finds it wanting. Implicit in that, of course, is that it just doesn't carry the appropriate language. And if 7.5 months later, all we have is something that perhaps an able attorney would have been able to rephrase the next day, do you think that gives any tilt toward the judge on why it didn't come in sooner? I mean, that's why I asked about discovery earlier and the like. I mean, if he feels that all that's happened, and maybe that's what led to that, a general comment by the judge, I don't know, about hunting up clients.
I don't believe so, Your Honor. I mean, I understand that in a circumstance where a judge, a district court, is trying to control its docket. It has the right to do so. And here it had the right to say, you have 30 days, 60 days, 90 days to file an amended complaint, whatever that may be. It didn't do so. And so left with a dismissal without prejudice, which the law makes clear, allows you to refile within the statute of limitations.
You're not arguing that if Judge Koukouras had said you have 30 days, and all that occurred is what, let's say, occurred here, that is, we have this second amended complaint, and 60 days later, it's filed. Would you say he would be within his discretion then to deny that because it was 30 days late?
I think it's a much closer call, Your Honor. But
so we have this arbitrary issue of if a district judge fails to put a marker down, then we run right to the statute of limitations on all amendments. Is that the rule that will come out of your case here? In other words, if we accept your approach, your case is most important to you and to us, but we've got to think down the line too. Will that be the rule? Would a district judge dismiss the pro se complaint without prejudice, sets no date for refiling, the statute of limitations then will be the end point for
that is the current state of the law, and I think that that's why
he could exercise no discretion within that time frame. Let's say sua sponte, even. In other words, enter an order not even permitting the filing because after 6 months nothing has come in and he alters the order.
I'm not sure what the basis would be for him or her to do so.
Well, just time aspects. In other words, if a complaint only needs the draft, the professional hand, should there be no discretion to be exercised by a district judge in shortening that time? That's all.
I'm not sure what the basis would be for that, Your Honor, because I'm not certain what the concern is that the district court's trying to take care of.
Within the statute of limitations, refiling is appropriate.
As long as, because there's no, obviously there's no prejudice to the defendant. The plaintiff could have waited until the last day of the statute of limitations to file his or her complaint. So in the circumstances where the district court wants to control the case, it has the opportunity to do so.
Well,
but where it fails to.
You have notified a party that the suit is in motion. It's temporarily stayed in effect or because of a dismissal. That party just has to wait till a period of statute of limitations and not expect further action other than this generalized notice of a complaint that did not hold up in court.
I think the answer to that is based on the Itosca case, which is a very interesting case where the plaintiff's complaint was there was summary judgment against the plaintiff. The defendant had counterclaims that were dismissed without prejudice. The plaintiff wanted to appeal the summary judgment of its complaint, and this court found that it could not do so until the time ran for the counterclaim to be refiled. So that is the state of the law, Your Honor.
Maybe a topic could be read that way. I don't know. I'm familiar with that.
Okay. Thank you very much, Your Honor.
Thank you, Twyford. Ms. Dillmeyer.
Please, the court, counsel. My name is Tamara Dillmeyer, and I represent the appellee, Commonwealth Edison, in this case.
Ms. Dillmeyer, may I start with where I started with him? If there had been no motion to file an amended complaint, simply a new suit had been filed, would that have been appropriate?
It's our position, no, for two reasons. The first reason is
they had no right to refile, even though it was dismissed without prejudice.
My position is no, and I'll explain why. Our position is number one, this court doesn't have jurisdiction to entertain any appeal over the dismissal of counts 5 and 6 of the First Amendment complaint. Our second position is...
Well, that's because of they weren't final, right?
Because
is that what you said?
No. Our position is this court does not have any jurisdiction to entertain the appeal of the dismissal of counts 5 and 6 of the First Amendment complaint. The reason why that is our position is because a final judgment was entered by the district court on September 25th, 2002. And I refer you specifically to that judgment because under the precedent of this circuit, it is the language of the judgment which controls this court's jurisdiction. It is not the language of the memorandum opinion or order or the language of any other document where we have a final judgment that's been entered. That final judgment is on page 25 of the appendix. The judgment states that all claims in the case are dismissed. It goes on to state, all matters in controversy having been resolved, final judgment is entered in favor of the defendant.
Your position is that it was not a dismissal without prejudice.
That's my position. I realize that the court did say certain counts of the complaint are dismissed without prejudice. However, this circuit has recognized in a number of cases that even if a complaint is dismissed without prejudice, if it's clear from the judgment itself that no amendment could be allowed or that the case has been dismissed in its entirety, then the only option the plaintiff has is to appeal. And that's what happened here. This case and this judgment meets every single criteria the Seventh Circuit has established for determining whether there is a final appealable order. It's in a self-contained document. It's complete. It states all claims in this case have been dismissed. All matters in controversy have been resolved. And most importantly, it states the relief to be granted. Judgment in favor of defendant and against plaintiff. In this court's decision in Paganis versus Blonstein, this court specifically recognized that when a self-contained judgment states judgment in favor of defendant against plaintiff, that is a final judgment, and Rule 58 does not require anything more to have a final judgment from which to appeal.
What was the date of that?
1993.
Specifically, what was the date of the denial of the motion to amend, Mr. Wood?
The denial for the motion to amend was dated July 3rd, 2003. So what happened in this case is the district court entered a judgment on September 25th, 2002, which the district court said was a final judgment. If for any reason other than the fact that it said it was a final judgment, the plaintiffs surely were on notice at that time that they needed to investigate whether this was a judgment from which they could appeal.
So you're saying the district court couldn't have amended it as it wanted to?
That's exactly right.
And if that's the case, then this, whatever this denial of a motion to amend and dismissal with prejudice is what, nothing?
Is moot, because once the court dismissed the entire action, as opposed to just dismissing the complaint, which did not happen here, under this court's authority in Car Carriers versus Ford, Paganis versus Blonstein, Viacom International versus Harbridge, and a number of other cases we cited in our case, once a judgment is entered dismissing a case, a plaintiff cannot then seek leave to amend a complaint without first filing a Rule 59E motion or a Rule 60B motion asking the court to reopen, amend, or vacate the
judgment. So if the plaintiff reads the judge's rule, which says it's dismissed without prejudice, he can't believe it. He has to go beyond that.
That's right. And the reason for that is twofold. Number one, this court has determined that the language of the judgment itself is what controls. That was determined all the way back in, I believe, 1987 in Benjamin versus.
So the language State. Without prejudice is the poor. He can't accept that. He's got to, wait a minute, Your Honor. I mean,
when he gets a judgment, if all that had happened was the memorandum opinion order was entered and the minute order was entered, mm-hmm. we wouldn't be having this discussion because the memorandum order says it's just dismissing the complaint. However, a final judgment was entered, and that final judgment makes clear that regardless of the fact that two claims or three claims were dismissed without prejudice, this is now a final judgment. The district court has said there is nothing you can do to amend the complaint. Judgment is entered in favor of defendant and against plaintiff. And to make that point clear, last March, this court decided in Hopkins versus Polstra, in a case where the district court entered an order stating the claims were dismissed without prejudice, but then also entered a judgment stating that the case was dismissed in its entirety, that judgment constituted a final appealable order. And the reason for that was is because the court said there has to be lines drawn somewhere. We will not divine what the intention of the district court was when they entered an order. When we get a final judgment that clearly indicates to us that the case has been dismissed and it is over, that is the document from which your appeal starts kicking.
So all this undue delay and undue prejudice is
irrelevant.
Not, yeah, and did is that what your side argued at the time?
our side argued that when they filed their motion for leave to amend on May 12, 2003, our response was initially, District Court, you don't have any jurisdiction to consider this argument because a judgment has been entered. And in this regard, whether the first judgment was entered as a final judgment or as a non-final judgment without prejudice has absolutely no impact on whether the district court had jurisdiction to consider their motion for leave to amend, because the case law clearly is, regardless of what type of a judgment is entered, if the complaint has been completely dismissed, before seeking leave to amend a complaint, the plaintiff must first file a Rule 59E motion or a Rule 60B motion. And that is the clear, undisputed holding of Car Carriers, Peganus versus Blonstein, Vicom versus Harbridge, and all the other cases we cite in our brief. The plaintiff did not file a Rule 59E motion. In fact, rather than doing anything within 10 days, which is the time limit for filing a Rule 59E, they waited 7.5 months. During that time, as the panel has already recognized, absolutely nothing happened in this case. To the contrary, the district court at the time of entering judgment made a notation on docket entry 36 of the docket, which is attached to the appendix, that the case was terminated. So rather than exercising any due diligence in this case to amend a complaint that the district court certainly recognized only required the plaintiff to brush up the pleadings and make them a little bit more clear, add a little bit more detail based on information that the plaintiffs already had in their possession when they filed the first amended complaint, the court said that was undue delay. And it also provides reason for why the court had the discretion, even if it were supposed to treat their Rule 15A motion as a Rule 59E or 60B motion, to deny both of those motions and end the case in its entirety, assuming that the first order didn't accomplish that. With respect to going back again to the jurisdictional issue, I want to refer the court's attention to the Supreme Court case that the plaintiffs cite because they rely on it heavily, and that's Semitic versus Lockheed. That case does not address whether a final order is appealable. That case only addresses whether an order entered in the United States District Court for the District of California dismissing a claim on the grounds of statute of limitations is claim preclusion with respect to the plaintiff filing the same claim or similar claims under Maryland law in Maryland State Court. And the court ruled that that order does not have claim preclusion because it didn't constitute a dismissal on the merits for purposes of claim preclusion. It has absolutely no impact or any bearing on whether the order before you is a final judgment from which the plaintiff should have taken an appeal. Another thing I want to clarify for the court is the second amended complaint was, in fact, the third complaint that had been filed by the plaintiffs. The first complaint was filed in September 2001 by a group of pro se plaintiffs. The next complaint was filed in April and was styled as a first amended complaint but did not state the parties that were supposed to be added to the first amended complaint. In June, the plaintiffs refiled another First Amendment complaint, which we've attached to our second supplemental appendix. So by the time the court dismissed this action in September 2002, the action had been pending exactly a year to the date. And during that time, no answer had been filed because the plaintiffs were unable, even after they retained counsel in April, far before the complaint was ever dismissed on September 25th, they were unable to amend their pleadings to make them state an appropriate claim. Those are some of the factors that the district court considered when they denied the Rule 15A motion for leave to amend. And I also want to draw your court's attention to the fact that even if you disagree with us, despite all the precedent to the contrary, that the September 25, 2002 judgment was not a final order, and therefore the plaintiffs had the right to refile a separate action since the first one was dismissed without prejudice. That is not what they attempted to do in May of 2003. They didn't file a new action. Rather, they moved pursuant to Rule 15A, requesting the district court to grant them leave to file a second amended complaint. And the case law on this issue is also clearly established that when someone moves pursuant to Rule 15A, the standard for determining whether the motion should be granted is abuse of discretion, and the court can consider a number of factors in making that determination. Here, the case had been dismissed in September 2002. Nothing happened in that intervening time. The case was completely removed from the docket. There was no indication from the plaintiffs that they intended to return to the court or that they intended to do anything to amend their pleading. As I said before, this court has recognized once a judgment is dismissed, even if you don't buy the Rule 59E or the 60B motion, the court cases of this circuit recognize that once the judgment is dismissed, any liberality presumption or presumption of liberality in amending pleadings goes away. DICOM, in that case, the plaintiffs moved 18 days after a judgment was entered dismissing the case to file an amended complaint. The district court denied that motion because they could have filed it before the motion to dismiss was entered, and the Seventh Circuit affirmed that. In Paganus, the plaintiff waited only 6 weeks to file a motion to file a second First Amendment complaint after the original complaint was dismissed. The district court denied that as untimely because they should have moved before the case was dismissed, and the Seventh Circuit also upheld that decision. Now, those are two cases that the plaintiff argues did not result in any dismissals without prejudice. That argument, although I disagree with it because it's not clear, I agree with that. It is clear from the record, as we point out on page 19 of our brief in Vicom, that the claims below were dismissed without prejudice. In Paganus, some of the claims were dismissed with prejudice. But the plaintiff's own argument proves that regardless of whether the judgment that was entered in 2002 was a final appealable judgment, once the complaint is dismissed, the judge has even broader discretion in denying a Rule 15a motion for leave to amend the complaint. In this case, the only thing the judge or the district court had to do in order for this court to uphold its decision is provide justification for denying that motion. And in this case, the district court did that amply. They relied first on the fact that there was so much delay. Second, on the fact that the pleadings could have been amended based on evidence that was already within their possession. Of significant importance here is they did not make any new allegations in their complaint. They relied on the same allegations as were amended in the First Amendment complaint and on exhibits that were attached to the First Amendment complaint and were clearly in plaintiff's counsel's possession at least as early as April 2002. And that is the primary thing that Judge Koukouras relied on, is you have waited too long. Even if you were attempted to find additional clients, that doesn't explain or justify why it took you 8 months to file an amended complaint that basically has done nothing but restate your claims under a new theory with additional fact information that was already available to you. In addition to that, the district court found that the prejudice to the judicial system was impacted by their failure to move soon and certainly to move before we filed our motion to dismiss. Notably, counsel that represented them when they filed the motion for the second amended complaint had entered an appearance in this case as second counsel of record in June, 4 months before this court granted the motion to dismiss. Certainly, they could have moved to amend after we filed our motion to dismiss, citing the fatal flaws in their case, and certainly before the district court granted judgment. However, as I've said before, the court need not even get to that point because a final judgment was entered on September 25th. If for no reason other than the fact that the judgment said it is final, this court should deny the appeal of counts 5 and 6 because this court does not have jurisdiction. It could deny the appeal from the Rule 15A motion, number one, because the district court did not have jurisdiction to consider that motion, and number two, even if it did, the district court did not abuse its discretion.
Right.
Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Dumas. So, your time had expired, but we had some extensive questions. You may have 2 minutes.
Your Honor, the focus of the inquiry seems to be on whether or not there's a final judgment at this point. And what I'd like to point out is that, you know, the Form AO450 that was entered, that counsel was referring to, is really a document created to kind of maintain the docket. And, a document created for that purpose shouldn't really be the one determining the substantive rights of the parties.
What do you make of her reliance on our case law?
What I can do is cite to you two cases also from this circuit that are listed in our briefs in which final judgment orders were entered and indicating that it was a dismissal without prejudice, and then this court found that the plaintiffs had leave to file.
Did the order which said this is a final judgment say without prejudice?
Yes. It commenced with saying that the dismissal of counts 5 and 6 are without prejudice, and then went on to say it's final judgment. And judgment order. The case of Furness versus Board of Trustees of Southern Illinois University, and the case of Benjamin. That's the one case without prejudice.
Is there a conflict in this circuit?
A little bit, Your Honor. Mm-hmm. A little bit. I mean, I think it is unclear, and it's not clear what.
It's okay to say it is.
I believe there is. Heaven knows we don't have small minds up here, so we don't have to be consistent. I just want to know if there was an inconsistency.
There seems to be, and I think that it's clear that the focus of the inquiry of this court should not be on the fact that there's a final judgment order entered. It should be on what happened. What was the intention of the order? What does it say? And of critical importance in a lot of the cases that determine whether or not it was a final judgment is whether or not the order says that it was a dismissal of the complaint versus the case. Here it clearly said it was a dismissal of not even the complaint, but just counts of the complaint without prejudice. So clearly the plaintiff should have, that wasn't a final judgment order, and the plaintiff should have been given a right to file an amended complaint. Thank you.
Our thanks to both counsel. The case is taken under advisement.